Hello, everybody. Welcome along to another edition of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. This is another of our Q&A editions. You do the Qs, we do the As. I am Aaron Noonan. He is Will Dar. Will, welcome. We are going to answer some questions. And I tell you what, we've done a couple of call-outs on socials this week. We've got some zingers. I hope you've come prepared with your bat ready to take some swings over the fence because there's some tricky ones.
Over square leg, over deep cover.
Wherever.
Mid on, mid off, yep. Silly mid off. Let's go.
Yep, reverse sweep for six into the members' pavilion. That's a good shot if you can manage to nail that one. Let's roll straight in. We get a huge abundance of questions for our Q&A podcast, so thank you to everybody who has taken the time to send them through on socials. We're sorry, we can't get to all of them. There's some that are just too hard. There are some also that are a little absurd, but there are plenty that are really interesting. And our first one actually came through this week, Will, on email, and this one got us digging. Which team has recorded the most front row lockouts in the history of the Australian Touring Car Championship and, of course, the Repco Supercars Championship as it's now known? Now, I'd have to reckon it's got to be a modern era team because of the sheer number of qualifying. So, you know, we qualify for every race, so there's far more opportunities than in the day of qualify once, race three times, where you, you know, start where you finish the previous race. Mm. It's got to be Triple Eight, doesn't it, by a mile?
By yes, pretty much by a mile. 45 times Triple Eight has locked out the front row.
Jeez.
Next best is the Holden Racing team through its iterations.
Now, that's sort of an interesting one because I reckon if you went pound for pound, they would be up there beating Triple Eight if they're in a different era.
Because, of course, the whole one qualifying session per every race is basically 09 onwards.
Yeah. And, of course, HRT, yeah, they did some poles and some winning in the years after that, but nothing like they were in the first part of that decade. So, no. Surely DJR's got to be the next best.
It's almost like you're reading off the list here because they
am.
Are.
Yeah, I am.
They are next best.
Well, given that they've had a few, well, they've had more as DJR Team Penske than as DJR, but of course there were so many qualifying sessions in the last 4 or 5 years versus, you know, what, 8, maybe 9 in a year in a championship year for Johnson and Bao in the Sierra days and the Falcon days.
That's and they actually lost one, Johnson and Bao, or they had a 1-2 qualifying result that doesn't count on this list because it was at Adelaide International Raceway in 1988, which had a 3-2-3 grid. So Andrew Medecki was on the front row with them, so it doesn't count
as a front row lockout because you've got to get all three.
Yeah.
And that would have happened a few times over the journey probably at AIR for other teams and other eras. Yeah. So one of those, and Surface Paradise, remember, was the same format there for many years, 3-2-3. So, yeah, interesting, isn't it? That's a cool question. Yeah. I really like that.
So just the final numbers on top, Triple Eight with 45, Holden Racing team on 29, Dick Johnson Racing, DJR Team Penske on 27. After that, Ford Performance Racing / ProDrive / Tickford on 22. Then Gibson Motorsport on 4, so a bit of a jump there. Brad Jones Racing have 3, and then there's a host of teams that have done it once.
And the Gibson Motorsport numbers would be so much higher if they had qualified for every race and multiple races and all that stuff back in that era, but you can only compare what the numbers are. You can't compare the woulda, coulda, shouldas.
Exactly.
Well, you could, but you'd be there for a while arguing things either way. Next question, Matt Hayward, he's a regular listener. When and where was the first safety car used in the Australian Touring Car Championship? Now, it's actually probably more recent than you think.
Yeah, because you think of the sort of 90s. It did happen in the 90s. In the 90s era, they're all sprint races for the most part, but the first safety car didn't come until the V8 Supercars era in 1997 at Simmons Plains.
In the wet.
Yeah, when the conditions got so bad they had to do something and they didn't stop the race, they threw the safety car out because they could.
And that's 10 years after it first appeared at Bathurst.
Mm.
So, at Bathurst, it was a staple from 87 onwards, but it just wasn't utilised because they were, you know, short races. So, yeah.
And there aren't too many races throughout that period in between that were actually stopped. I can only think of maybe a handful, like Lakeside 89 got stopped.
Yeah,
I think Malala 96 was another that got stopped.
Yeah, and they tended to stop them.
Yeah.
Whereas you know, if you had a safety car, you'd deploy it and fix it all up, clean it, one or two cars up. Malar 96, different case. Half the field was crushed at turn three.
The one coming onto the back straight, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right, exactly right. Hey, a little bit of a reminder too, Will, because Father's Day's coming up soon. Christmas is not that far away. I know it sort of seems like it is, but it's actually not really. You've got to get some presents. You've got to get onto it. Even if it's a present for yourself, we're here to help because that's what we're all about. We're here
tax
to help.
Tax refund time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, if you can claim it, buy it. Head to the website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. The link will be in the show notes. Jump on there. We've got some new stuff coming. We've got some stuff that's just come out. Of course, our Perkins Engineering Car History book's not far away. Coming together really well, looking really, really good. Some amazing stuff that you and Stefan have put together. Larry and Jack have been awesome. There's been so much help from car owners. It's really, really cool. Looking forward to seeing that one come out in a couple of months' time, late September, early October. We'll have that one in our hot little hands. The 90s Bathurst book too. That's one we announced recently. That'll be out in time for Christmas. A photo of every car from every year's great race from 1990 to 99. And yes, it has both the races from 97 and 98.
They were all Bathurst 1000s.
They were. And as a little bonus extra, the cars from the 99 Bob Jane Tiemart's Bathurst 500 Super Touring Race. Just as a, it's like a bonus DVD add-on extra.
While we're here.
While we're here. Yeah. And while we're here too, DVDs, 1994 Bathurst, the full race, out now.
Yeah.
Bit of a favourite.
Excited
yours.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah, bit of a favourite. Have you watched it 8 times yet?
At least.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. You're word perfect on the commentary from that race, aren't you?
It's the bits in the ad break that you didn't see at the time that are really cool. So, like, the Peter Brock crash late in the race happened during... Actually, I think it happened during, like, an hourly update.
Oops. Bad timing.
And what you see in that that you don't see in the broadcast was how close Tony Longhurst came to wearing the back of that HRT Commodore when he came upon the scene because he was the next. He was the first car there.
Some of the best, most amazing vision in Bathurst history happened in the ad breaks, and then it was rolled in as if it was live on a lot of occasions. And that happened in the eras that followed. And what was it? Time shifting was the term that was used, and of course it caught a lot of people out at Bathurst 2010. They were time shifting the race through to the end. Craig Lowndes and Mark Scaife won. But TV viewers saw them win about 25 minutes later because, well, in that era,
No Twitter, no real social media.
So, I think to the point where there were still bets being taken on the race result based off what was happening on the television. Of course, every time they went to an ad break, they'd pick it up at the next corner. But, of course, you went 3 minutes or 3.5 minutes further into delay every time you took an ad break. So, although you were getting to see the whole race, you just weren't getting to see it fully live.
I reckon someone made a lot of money that day.
Yeah, yeah. That was one that got them jumping and it never happened again after that. Do you want to find the next one?
Yeah. This one's from Josh Cochran. What do supercars have to do to rebuild support in both New Zealand and Western Australia after cancelling their events for the second year in a row? That's a bit harsh. Yeah.
I don't think they've got to rebuild their support. I think fair and reasonable Kiwi and Western Australian supercars and motorsport fans know how and why. It's not because they're not loved because of where they're from. It's just been a scenario that's been thrust upon us with COVID. WA's obviously been very, very protective of its border and it's been a bit of a fortress within Australia. New Zealand, another country, cross a ditch of water during these times, that's tricky.
Can you imagine if all the teams got stuck in New Zealand? After a New Zealand
Kiwi
round.
Fans would be stoked. Oh, yeah. You get 20 rounds in New Zealand.
Pukekohe 1000.
Oh, Shane would get to stay at home and at the Pukekohe 1000. Yeah. Having said that, I reckon New Zealand would be great if we're talking about, and clearly we need another enduro. And if they're not going to bring the Sandown 500 back, which I doubt they will because they continually show yo-yo-ness to the Sandown 500. It's on, it's up, it's down, it's in,
much
it's
like,
out.
Much like Sandown itself. It's sold, it's not, it's back, it's back.
Yeah, pretty much. Let's go to New Zealand for an enduro.
I like that. Pukekohe no shortage 500. Of tracks. Yeah, yeah. Like the good old days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not sure we're going to get a Wellington 500 up, but let's get a Pukekohe 500 up. But I don't think supercars have to rebuild any support. I don't think they've done anything wrong. They've tried their best in the scenario that's been placed upon them. So,
and it's like anything, like the fans in those areas have been starved of live V8 supercars for 2 years now. So when they do come back.
Not the first time that WA's been starved of supercars. There was this period there where we missed a year. Was it 2010? I think there was the year that there was no round there. So not the first time it's happened, obviously different reasons, different scenario. But I think that the support's going to be there when those returns finally do happen. People will be happy to see racing back at Barbagallo and, of course, in New Zealand, whether it's at Pookie or Hampton Downs or wherever, both or whatever happens. I don't think anyone who thinks that they've been slighted because they're from those two areas, I think you've been a bit harsh. I think that's way too harsh. Brenton Thorpe, what happened to racing at Queensland Raceway? I thought that was going ahead for the resumption of racing. Well,
speaking of tracks that are in, then out, then back out again.
Sold, unsold, sold, unsold. Well, basically, it just got to a scenario where things changed so quickly with all this COVID stuff. And that was the intention for everyone to get back from Townsville, then head to Ipswich because Queensland was in a, at the time, okay position with COVID. And now
it's not. Right now it's not.
Yeah. So that's the simple fact of the matter, Brenton, there, that that's just how it is. Yeah.
And it, having, like, it's what, an 11-week gap until the next race meeting now at Winton?
Yeah, I could grow a beard, actually.
You could, yes.
It won't be pretty. Well, but yeah, it's a beard.
There's a difference between could and should.
Yeah, yeah.
So, with that 11 weeks, hopefully the entire situation, all the COVID outbreaks in the various parts of Australia have calmed down or reduced significantly by then, and that hopefully will allow us to go racing in all these different places. And Queensland Raceway, I would assume, would still be a potential venue should any of the scheduled or TBA races fall over between now and the end of the season, with the exception of Bathurst, of course.
It starts to just depend on which end of the eastern seaboard is having the COVID drama as to which tracks pop up as.
Yeah.
Who would have thought last year, given what we were going through in Victoria, that we'd be the ones with two rounds on the calendar in October.
TBA.
Well, TBA, but let's face it, we're going to Phillip Island at the end of October. It's just a case of being officially announced. It's just the nature of things, how they swing around, and things move quickly, more quickly now than ever with this COVID stuff.
Chassis question from Adrian Fuller.
Adrian loves a chassis question or two.
This is a good one. Is Cool Drive back in their primary chassis that was crashed at the Mount Panorama 500? And also, is Will Brown still in EMH02 or back in EMH04, which he also crashed at the Mount Panorama 500?
There was a bit of crashing going on.
There was a bit. And which will be the wild card that Erebus uses for Murphy and Stanaway?
Bit to unpack there.
Yes.
Short answer, I believe Cool Drive is still in the spare chassis that they moved to after Bathurst when Tim Slade pancaked the number three car at the Mount Panorama 500. Will Brown swapped cars after that crash. He crashed at Bathurst in practice or qualifying. Practice, I think it was. And he's still in the car that he jumped into for the next round. So that repaired car from Bathurst will become the Murphy wild card for the Mountain, he and Richie Stanaway later in the year. So no real changes in chassis land there. So the changes were made after the crashes and they haven't gone back.
Yes.
So, one of the things we love is chassis history, no doubt about it, as to where the metal has been and who has been in it and done what with it. So, but this is another good one. Jamie Quinn, pretty easy answer to it, but it brings up the whole topic. If Scott McLaughlin makes Bathurst, which a month or two ago we were all saying, well, he's not going
0%
to. 0%
chance.
Then they move the date. And that opens up the chance for him to join DJR for the Repco Bathurst 1000. Jamie asks, if he makes Bathurst, do you think he'll be the primary driver as he will out-qualify Davo and Di Pasquale? Has this ever happened before that the co-driver came in as the primary over the full-time driver? Well, no.
No to the first part, because yes to the second part has happened before, just not at Bathurst, I don't think.
Well, co-driver can't take over from a primary driver because they are the co-driver. You're a nominated co-driver. Yeah. There have been scenarios where the co-driver's been given the gig to qualify. Jack Perkins did it for GRM with Alex Premer, 2012, I think it was. Pretty rare. But whoever, if Scott comes and drives at Bathurst, whoever he drives with, Ryan's story sounds like he's being a little coy as to who drives with who, a little bit of old school who drives with who speculation, which we don't get too much of these days because things are locked in so far out so early, generally.
Yeah.
Will and Anton will qualify those cars regardless.
They're the drivers that are in the cars all year. And it's one thing, like, we all know Scotty was a gun qualifier when he was in supercars. He was in the cars week in, week out. And that's where that final couple of tenths comes from, especially at a track that requires so much commitment. We saw what happened. Christ, was that last year where Scotty crashed at the top of the mountain during practice?
Which one was.
Like, in practice for the 1,000, just before qualifying. The final session
Elbow. Yeah.
Can't believe that was less than 12 months ago.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That's the level of commitment, and that's the sort of thing that can happen to a driver who's in the car all the time. And we saw with Davo when he came back into the sport full-time. He'd been out of the seat for most of a year, and finding those last couple of tenths in qualifying,
it takes a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And when you are the... Yes, you could. He could go and qualify. It's not against the rules for a co-driver to be given the opportunity to qualify a car, but he's there to be a co-driver.
Yeah.
Albeit a very well-credentialed and qualified one with a lot of current IndyCar experience, that's for sure. Dave Shelton, what chassis, love a chassis question, are the 888 boys running in Super 2?
Yes. So, Angelo Mazuras is in 888-045, which is the car that Craig Lowndes ran in 2017. That's the car Brenton Grove raced in Super 2 in 2018, 2019, and it's the same car Angelo was in last year.
Yeah, yep.
Brock Feeney is in 046, the car that Shane Van Gisbergen raced in 2017, and Kurt Kostecki raced that in 888 Super 2 program the last couple of years.
Yeah, 888 and Kostecki Brothers and Racing as well. Yeah, it's had a bit of an in and out sort of a scenario. He drove it last, I think, Adelaide. He did the first round last year in Adelaide and then didn't do any more once the COVID stuff had struck. So, there you go, Dale. That's what's going on with 888. Tom Doy, interesting question. Why are the commentary team talking about round points? Do you think they'll start awarding round wins again? I'd love to see rounds and progressive grids back in the championship and see the quicker cars fighting their way through the pack if they get unlucky in the first race.
See, we can have progressive grids without awarding round winners. We just have one qualifying session to start the weekend, but I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
Round points is interesting because it does give you a better indicator of who's gone well over the course of the weekend from a championship perspective. I personally like having race winners. I'm really glad that we went to that rather than having round winners, and I wouldn't look forward to it coming back.
I think it's an important thing. It became more of a factor last year when they started playing the tyre game of having effectively, like that race at Round of City Motorsport Park was a joke. Like, seriously, Jack LeBrock won a race. It's in the record books. But if you put his effort at the bend to finish second, that was a better performance than his win. It stands up high and it means more because that was tyre lottery draw. But it was absolute crap. It was...
Still won the race.
True. Taking nothing away
from
him.
They played the game for that race better than everyone else.
Everyone had the way out. But when you have a race where every car on the grid doesn't have a decent enough chance of winning, it was a joke. It was manufactured.
Don't have an equal chance of winning because of the decisions they made prior to that point.
No, but it doesn't matter what decision you make.
It does. If everyone chooses the same tyre strategy.
No, but you don't have a chance to win every race.
If everyone chooses the same tyre strategy heading into that,
but that's never going to happen because it was wound in a way that you can't.
Exactly.
So it's
you can't say it's an in
pub test. Does not pass the pub test.
It does. He won the race.
Doesn't pass the pub test. Doesn't pass the pub
test. You might not like it, but he won the race. He did what he had to do to win.
Go back and look at the video. He was not getting wowed up and wooing and hooing because he won his first supercars race.
History won't remember that.
He knew. Anyway, we're getting away from the point. I agree with you. I like that we give race winners fair acknowledgement. And I think it's a shame that we don't acknowledge the round winners anymore because it is important if you've performed the best over a weekend. But I don't think they're going to change it. I don't think that's going to happen. We've been doing it for over 10 years now. So,
well, if they award a trophy for the round winner, that confuses the narrative. You've got three.
Yeah, it's one or the other.
Yeah.
You're awarding race wins or round wins.
Because otherwise, at the end of the final race, you've got three people on the podium. Potentially, one of them has two trophies or there's a fourth person holding a trophy.
Yeah. And what the thing was that they changed it for was that they had – and this is classic because people don't do the data. And there was a feeling that, there were so many round winners who weren't winning any races to win the round. You know, how can you win when you don't win? Kind of thing. That doesn't really pass the pub test, does it? Mm. True. I would agree.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen that much. Mm. Happened occasionally. And you could think of instances where it happened. Steve Richards in Perth, I think in 2006, had a bunch of seconds and thirds, a few other times it's happened along the journey. But if you did the percentage of rounds for the 10 years before it or whatever it was, the percentage of round winners who didn't win a race that weekend was minimal. Hmm. So why change the whole thing and change the whole course of history in terms of how it's documented and recorded to suit something that, if you actually looked at the numbers, wasn't that most huge of an issue. There were bigger issues in supercars, and there still are anyway. But the other thing where it doesn't work out, if you have the Darwin Triple Crown or the event insert event name here, well, who's the winner of the insert event name here if you've got one driver that wins the Saturday, one driver wins the Sunday, but there's another bloke who actually scored the most points for the weekend?
Well, you do what they did at Clipsal, last person wins.
Yeah, that doesn't even pass the pub test either. It's a lot of pub testing going on here. I'm going to have to go to the pub.
It's 9:40. Settle down.
As we record this, it is a little early. It's 12 o'clock somewhere in the world, though, Will. 12 o'clock somewhere in the world. What's next? Still recovering from that. Yeah, nice.
Jacob Smith, what happens to the old safety cars?
Oh, good question.
Yeah. I imagine a lot of them would have just gone back to the dealership. Not all of them, but several of them probably would have.
Yeah, well, there's been so many safety car deals over the years in supercars. Remember they had a deal with Nissan for about 8 seconds with the Nissan GTR, but there was 4X beer on it. So I think Nissan went, we don't want to do that, and that deal fell
apart. High-performance car with an alcohol sponsor. Yes. High-performance road car, I should say.
Yeah.
Not the first time a Nissan's been a safety car.
Well,
in fact, the very
say-
first safety cars at Bathurst in 1987 were Nissans.
Nissan Pintara, I think, from memory.
And one of them broke.
Yeah, they had two. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, they probably needed about 8 of them.
Mm.
But then the thing that springs to my mind is that the 1992 Bathurst pace car, which was a Nissan GDR, became, this cool story, the Falcon Tyres Nissan GDR production car that raced in the 12-hour all of, what, 5 months later?
That's great, isn't it?
That would have never someone beat that.
Well, the 12-hour winning car in that race that the GTR took part in was then the safety car at the following Bathurst.
Good call. The Mazda.
Mazda RX-7.
It was too. If it wasn't the winning car, it was the sister car. So
first or second place car.
It was like
car.
Carrying the baton down the line. You get to be the safety car at this one, then you race at that one. And if you win that race, you can be the safety car at the next one. And then that sort of ended. But
yes.
I think there was Holden Jackaroos.
One of which was, I think, a Round Australia trial winning Jackaroo or
Bruce
Safari
Garland
winning
car
one.
Or something like that. Yeah. There were, you know, a bunch of Commodores. Yeah, and later on,
Gold Commodore.
Yeah. And once this V8 supercar era sort of started, there was clearly dedicated safety cars every year to, you know, sponsors. Yeah. And
Porsche safety car.
There was a Chrysler Hemi WPS thing that I reckon must have just.
That thing went for
like
a
you
lot,
wouldn't
yeah.
believe.
Feel like that was around for a long time.
Yeah, it was. I'd love to know any of our listeners own a car that they think might have been a safety car back in the day or know it was. Love to hear from you. I'd be interested to dig in the photo files and check some rego plates and see what we find.
That's funny because you think like the Indy 500 pace car has always been such a big deal. Like manufacturers would have like multiple release versions of the car from the year. It's just not really been a thing in Australia.
It's not really. No, not even close.
Opportunity being missed here.
Pace car sleuthing. Safety car sleuthing.
Safety car sleuthing.
There's probably a few to run through.
Well, we know one of them at least.
The Nissan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
potentially the Mazda.
Yeah, that's true. Well, if anyone out there does have a safety car, love to hear from you.
Yeah.
Drop us a line through our website, v8sleuth.com.au or through the socials, you know where to find us. I think that's tickled my fancy so much, Will, that I'm going to give that our motorsport trader question of the week. There's no prizes up for grabs. It's just the chest beating. So, Jacob Smith, congrats. Well done. You have got our motorsport trader question of the week. Of course, you can visit the team at themotorsporttrader.com. They are keeping your motorsport memories alive with a range of panels and suits and car parts and all sorts of memorabilia, supercar stuff, GT stuff. Even a bit of old Formula One stuff's popping up in there now. Luke and the team have got some really cool stuff. So head on to their website, themotorsporttrader.com. And, of course, if you've got anything that you're looking to sell, they handle consignment stuff too. So if it's all too hard for you to deal with, make it their problem.
They've got the active audience. They will have someone who will want your thing.
That's right. So if in doubt, handball out. That's the go. David Cowley, David Cowley, what happened to the Bundaberg Red Racer that Fabs tumble dried through the chase back in 2010. Was it a write-off or was it resurrected?
It was resurrected, but it has not returned in a racing capacity is probably the best way to answer it. So that car was rebuilt and came back as a it was actually at racetracks the following year, still in Bundaberg colours, but as like a pit stop challenge.
Yeah, thing changed the wheels and all that sort of jazz. Yeah, on display.
Yeah, but it has not raced again since.
No, and that's with a private collector, I understand, in Melbourne with a long-term restoration plan. Hmm. But I think the thing with that car, that was Walkinshaw chassis WA008 from memory off the top of my head. That was Garth Tander's car in 2008 for Holden Racing Team, the year that he won the L&H 500 with Mark Scaife. He won the Winton round when they had that three-way tie with Wincup, Will Davison, and Garth.
So is that Mark Scaife's last HRT winning car?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Didn't win again after that. Yeah. That was his last win. So, yeah, and that car won a lot of races that year, but didn't win the championship, didn't win Bathurst. So, it's kind of a bit forgotten. So, if you did have that car, albeit it's best known for its Fabian flip-flip.
It's best known for being upside down in a million pieces.
But if you looked at its history, you'd put it back to HRT car.
Surely.
I'd reckon.
But yeah. It was a good-looking livery that year too.
Yeah, yeah. The fluoro-y red and white.
Nod to 88 sort of deal.
Yeah. Bit of that going on. Yeah. No. Cool car. But yeah, it still exists. It's not dead. It's still around.
Next question from Brendan Hartzer. Whatever happened to the pack leader EF Falcons that were raced in 1996 by Alan Jones and Paul Romano? And a second part to that question. Are the two Alan Jones cars which caught fire at Lakeside in 1995 and at Bathurst in 1996 still around?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Yes.
Smolderingly, yes. Short version, the Alan Jones 96 pack leader barbecue car became Jason Bright's 1998 Bathurst winning car. Mm. So from barbecue to Bathurst win in 2 years.
Yeah.
It's always handy. That's in the hands of a private collector now. So that car is still around. The Paul Romano car, the 201 pack leader car, I don't think anybody else has raced with 201 on their car before or since.
Or 301 for that matter.
Yeah, that's true. That became Mark Larkham's car the next year when he'd been running his own car and then went in with the Stones for the following season. So he just slipped into what had been the Romano car, and then that ended up shunted down at Phillip Island in a pretty big way off the start line and tasting the Earth Bank on the run down there. They put together another car for him to get through the rest of that year, but the Romano car did get salvaged and race later on over the journey. It's with a private collector up in Queensland. And the Alan Jones other fire car, there were a few, hard to keep up with them, was a PJ car, and that one still exists as well. So they didn't burn to the ground and gone forever. They all find a way to survive and live on, which is pretty much a lot of the times, whether it's been crashes or fires and you think these cars are gone or going to be gone, they survive. They find a way. They're very good.
Yes.
You know, they're like the nuclear cockroaches, you know. They just keep on finding a way. Brett Pitfield's question, where and what is Mark Osler up to these days? Well, you see him a bit online, don't you, with plenty of his content in Shannon's land?
Yeah, he does a lot of work with the Shannon's Club, a lot of feature writing. Of course, Mark, long-time commentator back in the days of the Australian Touring Car Championship in the early days of V8 Supercars, founding editor of Australian Muscle Car Magazine.
Which would you believe? Next year is 20 years since started. 2002.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
That's incredible.
I feel old. Really, yes. I do.
No, same. I remember when I think the first issue of that I bought was issue 3 about the supercar scare in 72.
Oh, yeah. Worth a bit, those early editions, particularly the originals. They did do reprints of some of those first ones, but if you've got some of those tucked away, you're going all right. If I see him on eBay, though, tomorrow, I know that you took my advice and went a bit too far with it.
And, well, I don't have issue 1 and 2, so if I have done that, I'll take yours.
I was going to say, I'll go check where ours have gone from the office if they so happen to accidentally turn up. Yeah. I have asked Marco to come on the podcast, and he's a bit reluctant. He is a busy guy. He's got plenty of content to create out there at the moment. He's got plenty going on in his world with his family. I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to keep trying to find some time to rope him in and get him to sit down in front of a microphone for an hour and have a chat. I think he's a very humble guy. He doesn't really talk himself up too high and hard, which he should, because he's done some cool stuff and been to some cool places over the journey. So I think we should
Like, he was there at the start for a magazine that has now lasted 20 years and has been a key part of...
In this world, that's pretty good effort.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Next question from David Roberts. Should Motorsport Australia award the title of Australian Grand Prix to the proposed S5000 race at Mount Panorama?
I've heard a bit of this sentiment in recent times about if there's no Formula One Grand Prix, that if there can be the Grand Prix title attached to an S5000 race, it should be.
I reckon it probably can't be.
It's wishful thinking. Yeah. It's romanticism at its finest, but it's not going to happen.
There'd be so many clauses in the contract with Formula One to prevent the words Australian Grand Prix being used in any sort of motorsport context outside of the Formula One Australian Grand Prix. I just don't see how that could happen, which is a shame because it would be cool if a independent Australian Grand Prix could be run independent of Formula One.
Yeah.
Awarded to
back to where it was once upon a time. It wasn't a Formula One World Championship race. Yeah. It was a Formula 5000 race. It was run to Tasman-era regulations, Formula Pacific. It's been a bit of everything over the journey. But there's a reason why, apart from Bob Jane at Calder, it was pretty much on its knees. No one cared about it. It was the thing that was on at 10 a.m. Sandown September, Sunday morning, before the touring cars rolled out, which people turned up for. So there's a reason why these things don't happen anymore. But I love the romanticism in David's question and the viewpoint of many who've thought this. But, good luck getting through all those clauses.
Yeah.
Ben Wilkinson, when was the last time a new model or brand of car was introduced halfway through a season? And I'm presuming he's talking about supercars.
You have to go back quite a while. It was the VT Commodore, which was introduced with three rounds to go in the 1998 championship. And it was introduced at that particular point because Holden had wanted it to race at the Bathurst 1000 that year, naturally. And as part of the agreement between Cams and Tiga to allow that to happen, it was agreed that they had to run it in the last three rounds of the Australian Touring Car Championship to not fudge. Exactly. Basically. To demonstrate they weren't going to turn up at Bathurst.
I thought you were going to dance around it. No, straight in.
Yeah.
Straight in.
To make sure they didn't turn up at Bathurst with a rocket ship. And one of the clauses in that was that the car had to be driven by whichever team decided to run the VT. The car had to be driven by the driver of that team that was highest in the championship points at the time, which the two teams that debuted, of course, Holden Racing Team and Perkins Engineering, and their two drivers were the two championship contenders, Craig Lowndes and Russell Ingall.
And Larry fought it vigorously. Jeff Gregg fought it vigorously. So they won first up because Greg Murphy drove at Calder and Larry Perkins drove his new car at Calder. But then for the next round at Darwin, it was forced upon them that they had to put their hot shoes, their championship combatants, Lowndes and Ingall, into the VTs. And, of course, as it turned out, Ingall had a good run in Darwin and Lowndes had a better run at Oran Park and finished it off and won the championship. And Larry and Russell won Sandown and the Pertec Falcon won Bathurst, although the HRT car was probably the fastest car on the day. So, yes, 1998, Ben. That was the day that race three got canned because it was too wet. Murph went out in the VT, splashed around, and drove it straight back to the garage in the paddock.
No, thank you.
And they said,
no, thank
righto,
you.
Righto, let's call it. He's done, so we're done. That was it. I was there that day.
Still drying out?
Pretty much, yeah. That was...
Wet day at Calder, that would have been cold as well.
Well, it wasn't even a wet day for the whole day. It was only for that part. It only came before that third and final V8 race, and it shut it all down. So, still.
Because who doesn't love driving a touring car on VHT compound in the wet?
Yeah. Calder wasn't a very good track for racing, really. And then in the wet, not that flash. Dave Dukas asks, how far do cars get pulled down or serviced between events? Well, simple answer, very. They pull them right apart. These things, you wouldn't recognize it as a race car if you walked in the workshop a week or two after a round. Then everything's out, everything's being lifed, everything's being serviced, replaced, repaired, checked, double-checked. They go right through it.
Yeah. They definitely make full use of the time in between rounds that's available to
them.
Got
a bit at the moment, just quietly.
Yeah, those cars are going to be in such good condition when they roll out at Winton.
Yeah, they'd want to be. No excuses for anyone who's got anything that's not quite right on them. There's been just a little bit of time. Troy Allen, next question. How many drivers have won the championship but never gone on to win the 1,000 at Bathurst? Or let's say the 500 in the years that it was a 500. It's a pretty small club, but it's Some pretty heavy hitters in there.
Yeah, well, it's smaller after last year because Shane Van Gisbergen was on this list but got himself off it. Yep. Yeah.
So out of the club.
So there's now seven drivers on this list, one of whom can get themselves off it potentially this November. David McKay, the 1960 championship winner, did not win the great race. Bill Pitt also didn't win the great race. Norm Beachy, renowned as a touring car racer, but
wasn't really into the great race.
Nah, serious production wasn't his thing, really.
Nah, did a little bit of it in the Armstrong 500 days at Phillip Island and stuff like that, but at a time when the touring car championship and Bathurst were separate in terms of the rules and the types of cars that raced, so he was kind of in that era, but Bathurst never really floated his boat.
No. Robbie Francovic,
yep,
championship winner in the Volvo, but yeah, never really got a good crack at the great race.
Not really.
Only went there once with the Volvo. He 85. He didn't quite make it there the following year with Volvo. He was in a different car.
Well, that was the year he won the championship. So exactly, how would that be? That'd be like, you know, Shane Van Gisbergen wraps up the championship and gets sacked before the first endurance race of the year. I mean, that's the modern day equivalent, which would make the stories and the headlines spin for months on end, but it happened back in the day. Those were the glory days, Will, when, you know, teams got drivers sacked mid-season, and oh yes, that was the good stuff. That was good stuff. Those were the days. We miss it. Well,
your calls and questions can be addressed too.
But one of the things that we struggle with, we don't have ins and outs. That's one of the greatest parts of the football news cycle every week is players injured, players suspended, player debuting, player coming up from the VFL or the second league in the NRL. It's one of the things that fuels the whole news cycle. So we just don't have that because we have pretty much a stable, solid crew of 24, 25 drivers right throughout the course of the year, and doesn't really, really often change.
Yeah, and to a large extent, crew members are the same and also not as high profile as the players on the AFL players or rugby league players on the paddock.
Exactly. So the that's four.
That is four.
The other three are Glenn Seaton.
Yep.
Marcus Ambrose.
Yep.
And James Courtney.
Yes.
He's the one who's got the chance to get himself off that list later on in the year. I don't think he's going to get off that list.
Well, he's got as much chance as everyone else at this point.
I wouldn't say he does. Why would he have just as much chance?
Well, no one's started the race yet.
Yeah, I know, but there's guys in faster potential cars with better co-drivers.
Yeah. He's in a Tickford car. Those have gone pretty well at the mountain. He didn't do a bad job last year.
He got smoked by the bloke in car six. Mm. They all did.
Yeah.
So it's, Courtney's not winning Bathurst. He's not getting off that list. Lock it in.
James, the phone number you need to ring is...
Oh, no. He can ring if he likes, but he ain't going to win Bathurst. His best chance to win Bathurst was in the Stones cars. It's the closest he got, and he couldn't quite get it done. Got on the podium, what, three times in a row? 6, 7, and 8?
Yep. Yep, with Glenn and Bezzy.
He's been up there since with Jack Perkins, but I can't see that he's in a position to be. You're right. Anything can happen at that race, but I can't.
Yeah, saying someone can't win is a very big call.
I can't see that he's going to win it.
Okay,
I can't see he's going to win it.
Next question from Elliot Beaton: how did the deal work out for Noons to host the CMS DVD releases? Wouldn't this have been awkward if you'd asked yourself that question?
Yeah, would have been really stupid, wouldn't it?
It's almost like we planned that one.
Yeah, you would have got a question and answer off. You'd be just sitting there having a cup of tea. No real great story behind this one. I had seen that the Chevron Motorsport guys were releasing DVDs, obviously off the back of previous era of VHSs, and a lot of it was the same stuff repackaged, and I simply told them that there's more stuff than you know that exists. They thought that they'd kind of tapped it all out and there wasn't anything left, but with what I was doing at the time, and this is 2012-ish, 11, 12, with supercars, my time on supercar TV, so Channel 7 era, being in the archive at 7 doing some V8 extra stuff and other bits and pieces, alerted me to the fact that there was more stuff there that just hadn't been touched. And it was in Melbourne, so I was in Melbourne, so I was able to see some of it. So had a bit of a chat to them, told them what was there, proposed what we could do. I'll sift through it. I'll figure out what goes on each release. I'll host them. I'll script them. I'll do all the bits. They'll do the rest, make it all happen. And here we are. I think we've probably released 50, 60 titles over the course of nearly the last decade.
A lot of good stuff, a lot of good Bathursts. A lot of good Bathursts that people thought were long gone.
Yeah, that's right, and the full race version. So when we say that, it's including the ad break vision. So you didn't see it on the day because you were watching ad breaks. So if you've recorded the race from back in the day on your VCR or whatever, there's a vision you haven't seen because the cameras were still filming and it was being recorded. But
you can ride along with Peter Brock in the BMW M3 when he looks down and hits the tyre.
Oh, you've beaten me to it. It's one of the that's probably the greatest little mystery of how that happened. He wasn't looking out the front of the windscreen. In 88, the BMW had the in-car camera down in the passenger footwell pointing back up. You might remember Crompton did the big spool backwards and forwards with Doug Mulray and Wilco and Raymond and Brock later on in the day. But if you look at the – and you can buy it. The 1988 Bathurst in full is available from our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. 94 Bathurst is the latest one. 95 and 96 coming out a little bit later this year, not too far away. But Brock's looking down in the car and then there's this big bang and he's cleaned up a tyre sitting on Conrod Strait on the road. And he says in the interview afterwards, oh, you know, I looked up and there was this tyre. He didn't look up. He belted it. Yeah. Like he dead set just smashed it without looking.
Can you imagine if the camera feed had actually been coming from the headlight cam that was in the grill of the BMW M3 at the time? And it's just comes over the rise and just drives straight into this tyre.
Yeah,
would have been hard to explain.
Action replay, that's for sure.
Next question, staying on the CMS DVD theme, is from Matthew Davis. Are there any plans with CMS to release more races on DVD from the 1995 season? Enjoyed the best of 1995 volume and would like to see some more. It was a good year.
It was a good year. That's why we released the best of 1995. I think that was last year we did that one from memory. I had to check our little master sheet of what rounds are on what releases and titles. So there's 4 of the 10 from 95 yet to be released. They're Simmons Plains, Phillip Island, Lakeside, and Winton, as far as I could do the quick count from. So what we do with these is we don't tend to release them by year. We've done a few year-related releases, but we do them by tracks or by eras of car. Or we've got to come up with a theme. We want to keep it fresh. So I'd say, Matthew, in the journey, those ones somewhere, somehow will get a run somehow. We've released more of the Touring Car Championship rounds from the Channel 7 era than we have not. So 1985 to 1996, we've released more than half of what's available there. So there's still plenty of other stuff to dig out, plus more touring car rounds as well. So keep your eyes peeled for down the track as well. Peter Alexander is a Ford nut. We know this about Peter because he sends a lot of Ford-related questions.
As this one is, by the looks of things.
Yeah. He's been listening to the Marcus Marshall podcast that we did a few weeks ago. And he heard that the 888 FG Falcon that was destined for the Team Inter Racing team that Marcus was driving for is the car that became the 888 Holden ride car development mule in the end. And he says, would it be possible to reverse engineer it back to FG spec and for it to eventually race in Super 3?
Look, it's all metal, so it's not impossible.
Well, it's probably too far gone. But the reality is it never raced as an FG.
No.
And to be eligible, it's got to have race history as what you're going to race it as. So, yeah.
Was that car ever registered as a V8 supercar?
Because
it never raced, so
no.
It would never have had to have been.
No. So that's the first 888 Commodore. They'd started building I think a bunch of 7 of them at the start of 2009. And this was another one after that, which was for Inter, that started in a BF and never got out of it because the team collapsed before it got much further. There was an announcement somewhere along the line that 888 were going to build a ride car. So I presume – and at the time, they were still running FG Falcon race cars. So the plan – it was an FG chassis underneath. It was going to be a Falcon ride car because, of course – teams didn't really want to use their race cars all the time for ride days. They wanted to be able to.
Well, it's discussed with the way they prep them in between races.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Exactly right. So that's where that came to be. That's the car that Jenson Button drove at Albert Park and at Bathurst as well. A bunch of different people have driven it across the journey on ride days and ultimate speed comparisons at the Grand Prix and all sorts of stuff over the journey. But it's. You couldn't race it in Super 3. You couldn't. You could if you spent a lot of money, put it back to an FG, but it never raced as an FG. It was never registered as an FG. Yeah. Wouldn't be eligible for Super 3 anyway. And the other element is that Super 3's, the goalposts are going to change there anyway. So Super 2 is going to be for the ZBs and the Mustangs when they go into there, and the older car, the future cars, the Altimas, the VF, Commodore, the what else, the FG, Falcon, they'll be, in essence, Super 3 cars. Mm. So all those pre-2013 cars will be out, and I guess that's probably a question for us to ask Australian Racing Group. Do they revive what was V8 touring cars?
You would think. Surely there's...
Surely you'd have to. Yeah. You'd think so. So... I think we've answered that one, haven't we?
I think so, basically.
Yeah. Nice thought, though. Peter's always thinking about this stuff. Mm. Good question. Good question. Adam Hudson, besides Peter Brock, who has the most race starts in the number 05? Now,
it's a good question. It's a great question.
I spent some time with our AN1 data analyst, Shane Rogers, during the week to split through the race results to figure out who was the co-driver that, I mean, there's a few logical people that you would presume.
Yeah, but then people you drill, co-drove with 05.
Yeah, but then
05.
You drill a bit more on other events that are a bit off the radar and things like that over the journey, and you actually find quite a few interesting races that you've forgotten about. So it's in my mind, it's Jim Richards.
That would make a lot of sense because, of course, there were, what, 4 Bathurst 1000 mm-hmm. starts together, 3 yep. of which ended in victories.
Yep.
Then he came back and drove with Brock in 88. Admittedly, at Bathurst and at Wellington in 56.
Yep.
But they were in Enduros before that.
Oran Park, they won.
Yes. Brock's only win in a BMW.
Yep. And Sandown.
Yep.
The 05, I was yep. there, I saw it. The 78 Rothmans 500, the car went out early, but Jim was the co-driver, so that counts.
Yep.
The 96 Bathurst Super Touring support race. Where he drove the Brock Volvo because Brock was committed to HRT for the weekend.
Yep.
So I've got 7. Thomas Mazira did 6. Sandown and Bathurst 3 years in a row.
Oh, yep.
Andrew Medicki did quite a few.
Oh, yes.
1990 yeah. Sierras at Sandown, Eastern Creek, Wellington and Pookie, and then in the Commodore the next year at Sandown and Bathurst.
Mm-hmm. Larry would have done a few.
Not as many as you think, though.
5 at least.
Well... How many Bathursts do they do? 82, 3, 4.
Yep.
Sandown in 84.
Yep.
That's it.
And the Nissan Mobil races in 91.
Oh, yeah. So, what does that get him to?
I think that gets him to 6.
That's 6. So, he's one short of Jim.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of sixes here.
A lot of sixes.
Thomas, Medicki, Perkins. But Jim stands out on top.
Yeah.
As he does on most record books when you
yes.
when you add it up. If you ever have a category of most wins in just about anything.
It's probably Jim.
Yeah, it's probably Jim. Yeah. he's probably somewhere up there. So, yeah, there you go.
Next question from Chris Williams. How many different types / brands of gearboxes or transaxles have been used since the start of 5-litre touring cars in 1993?
Jeez, we're getting nerdy today, aren't we? Massive tech, massive mechanical deep diving here.
You're asking the two least technical people.
Well,
we know facts and information, so we couldn't tell you how they work.
I'll have a dip.
Okay.
Well, let's go backwards. Cool. So, if you go backwards... The X-Track's the current transaxle in the supercars mm-hmm. in the main game.
Yep.
The Albans was the previous one prior to that. The Hollinger gearbox was the – and there's a few iterations of gearboxes from Hollinger over the years. There was sequential and there was H-pattern, but there was also a couple of different designations.
Variants within.
Yeah, that's right. I reckon some of those very early 5-litre cars, maybe a Gary Wilmington or similar, used a Getrag.
Yep, that would make sense.
I reckon a couple of those just filtered across. And the other one that I – just remember the other day because someone mentioned it to me. Richard Mork ran a 4-speed in his Commodore in the late 90s.
Really?
Yep. Huh. Yep. The VP before he VR'd it, that at one stage had a 4-speed in it. True story.
There you go.
So there's one that would have won some pub trivia, that's for sure. So I think that's, I didn't count up how many that was, but that's 4 or 5.
Yeah.
Bit of gearbox memory lane.
There you go.
Yeah. You sound genuinely shocked.
I genuinely am. A 4-speeder in a V8 supercar era is quite
the surprise.
I think
it's the only 4-speed supercar in history.
Well, one that rolled out of the pits with 4 gears. A few have come back with 4 working gears left, but...
That's true. Yep, yeah, true.
Next question from Zach Dowdle. Any plans for a book on the history of Super 2?
No plans.
Yeah.
No plans. It'd be cool.
Oh, yeah.
But it'd need a corporate partner to help fund it because it simply wouldn't have the sales appeal, I don't think, that... Some of the other book titles that we do or we plan to do, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So
it would be a cool book, but yeah, it needs that commercial viability for it to make sense.
Yeah, not far away from the 25th anniversary.
Wow, that's snuck
up. 2000, Konica V8 Lights is when it started.
Yeah.
So if you count the season, what are we now? Yeah, I mean, 2025 is not that far away.
23rd season.
Yeah, you could do the 25th season.
Yeah.
Mm. So, look, if someone threw us some corporate money and put their logos all over it and helped pay for it and to create it, I'd be up for it. But it would have to fit into our schedule. We've got a pretty busy schedule of what we've got on the cook, what we're planning for next year and for beyond. So we tend to work sort of 18 months out from what books we're going to do and when we're going to do them. So thanks for the question, Zach. Thanks, everyone, for the questions that have rolled in on this Q&A edition of the podcast. Don't forget to... I keep saying it, but please head to our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Bunch of DVDs, bunch of books, perfect gifts for Christmas and for Father's Day. We've got a pre-owned section. We've got some really cool motorsport gems, old race programs from the 70s, 80s, 90s. If you're looking for something in particular that's not on there, send us a message. We might have it here in the boxes, but we just haven't got around to putting it up on the website yet. Full years of various years of motorsport news and auto action magazines. So if you're digging for a particular history on a car or you're trying to fill a collection up, drop us a note, have a look on the website. If you don't see what you're after, shoot us a note because there's every chance of sitting here in under our feet here in the boxes in the office.
There's a lot of stuff around here at the moment.
We have a very content-rich environment here.
that's a good way of putting
it. At Sleuth headquarters, we've got it all going on. So thanks again, everyone. We'll do these Q&As a little bit more over the course of the rest of the year. We've got some special plans cooking for the pods for the rest of the year. Don't forget Repco Supercars weekly every Tuesday with the latest in the Repco Supercars Championship. In the meantime, though, we are done. Thanks again for listening. We will be back next Wednesday with another edition of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Check you then.